So, we're on the second interview with Colleen Smith, or Colleen McCabe, sorry. And so last time, you talked about the starting to get involved in the academic staff, and you talked about your experience with the grievance committee. And then you told me a little bit about Hayes Hill and the titling process that went on. And you said you were also on a gender equity salary study. So mm-hmm. I'll ask you about that in a minute. But if you can just think back to that time that you were in the grievance, on the grievance committee. During that time, and from your perspective, what do you think, how would you characterize the relationship between the faculty and the academic staff? You said at one point in your interview, and this was related to the grievances, academic staff were subject to the whims of a powerful faculty member. And I'm sure you saw that in the grievances. But in general, from your perspective, what was the relationship between the faculty and the academic staff at that time?
In general, I think it was good. I was working at the computing center, which did not have faculty. So if there were any issues in that arena, it was that there were academic staff and classified staff perhaps doing the same work. So there might have been a little cultural issues there. I did not know that much about faculty interactions with academic staff unless it came to the grievance level.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it gets to that level, it's contentious, but it's just between a couple of individuals, and I can't paint a broad brush
right.
over the whole faculty
right.
or the university, because I just did not know.
Right. So tell me then also a little bit about the academic staff versus classified staff relationship.
In the computer science complex, at the time, there was MAC, which was the Madison Academic Computing Center, side by side with ADP, which was the Administrative Data Processing. So MAC people basically supported the academic side, so faculty and graduate research, where ADP did the payroll, did the programming for the whole university. And we had certainly different roles at that time. However, on either side of the fence, there were people doing programming. And so this is when this showed an issue when Hayes Hill came up, because at this time there were computer people doing similar work on both sides, and Hayes Hill made a good case for some of the computing people to be moved to into the state civil service.
Yeah.
Well, the campus fought tooth and nail to keep as many people and academic staff as possible, because they have a lot more latitude for hiring and firing
yeah.
if they're not in civil
right.
service. And also, academic staff people start out with 4 weeks of vacation, where classified start out with two. And
yeah.
However, particularly on the programming, computer programming side, the civil service actually paid more.
Yeah.
So there were pros and cons, but there was often a clash there of
mm-hmm.
of values when they merged into the Division of Information Technology. There was no longer that separation into academic and administrative, and so people might be working side by side in an office, one classified and one academic staff.
Doing basically the same thing.
Right.
And one, the classified, in this case, being paid more.
Right, which wasn't that much of an issue, because people were happy to be academic staff. The ADP managers who were used to having all classified staff under them now got some... used to having all classified staff, now got some academic staff who had a little bit more freedom of work rules. So at Mac, you know, if we each had our own office and our own jobs, and if we had to be out or we had to be at a meeting, we would put a sticky note on our door saying where we were and when we'd be back. Well, the ADP managers just were not going to accept sticky notes on doors. I mean, this was just antithetical to how they operated. You have to have permission, you know, you had to account for every minute. So there were a few things to be worked out in that arena. Mm-hmm. But basically, it worked out fine. The people who got, you know, their undies in a bunch more than the actual workers were the HR people. Because for one thing, Hayes Hill moved all the HR people into classified staff. I mean, everybody was grandfathered until they left the position, but it was the position that was changed, not the person.
Yeah.
So it made a lot more work, and a lot more issues came up for the HR people and the managers than the actual people who did the work when we just went about doing our work.
Right, right. Okay.
Which is often how people are.
Right, right.
Down in the trenches.
Right. Just go about doing your work.
Right. Right.
Okay. So let's move on to the gender equity.
Okay.
Salary.
All right.
This was, had you finished up with the grievance committee at some point and then took this on in place of that?
No, I think the gender equity might have been first. I don't remember a whole lot about it. It was pretty early, just after I started working here. UW system, shortly after governance, UW system decided to do a gender equity study because there seemed to be a lot of complaints from women in particular that they were not getting paid fairly, the same as men who were doing the same kind of duties. So they had a study and looked at, I think they looked at academic staff as well as faculty, and found there were indeed gender discrepancies, which they ended up fixing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember, I remember being on the committee, I remember talking about wording a document, but I don't remember much else about it, other than the data showed up gender equity problems that were solved for the moment. I must say, after a few years, things kind of
drifted back
as they are known to do. Yeah. But at least a stab was made at trying to even things out.
And so how was that evened out? By changing job titles? By increasing people's salaries?
For faculty, it was increasing the salaries. For academic staff, it might have involved some retitling because titles were tied into salary ranges.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was about money. It's always about
it's
the money.
It's always about the money.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you said you were also on the nominating committee.
Right. So the Academic Staff Assembly has a number of standing committees, one of which is nominating. And that committee is charged with recruiting candidates for the standing committee slates for the elections, and then also for recruiting people willing to serve on campus-wide what were once known as faculty committees but now are known as shared governance committees.
Mm-hmm.
So being on the nominating, people that are usually elected to that, they try to have people from different sections of the campus and also choose people that might know people.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that I was one of the most knowledgeable people when I was new, because I came into a situation in the nominating committee that was a little bit of a quagmire when I got into it, and that was that they had a very excellent, organized, strong chair
of the
nominating committee.
Oh, okay, I see.
Who was in the med school. I believe maybe he was even in the hospital then because they were one and the same. And an equally strong-willed person who was chair of the academic staff committee. And the nominating committee did its research, carefully chose people for the slates, asked people to serve on shared governance committees, and as stated in the bylaws, submitted the list to the academic staff executive committee. Well, at the time, the academic staff committee had a lot of sort of people who were involved in governance from the beginning or from early on and had ideas about who they wanted to have running or appointed and would at times ignore the suggestions of the nominating committee to appoint whoever they wanted. And this is my opinion and that might not be shared, but it seemed to be kind of getting to be a good old boys type of, not that it was all boys, but a good old boys mentality of appoint your friends or appoint who you knew and reappoint people. So those of us on the nominating committee who did not like that attitude, and especially the chair, fought back, and eventually the chair quit.
Oh, the chair of the nominating committee quit.
Yeah.
Because he or she was not successful.
And was not happy about the way they were treated. And the two just did not see eye to eye at all. So, and I'm kind of new, so this is all kind of uncomfortable for me, but it was a good learning experience. And, you know, so I stayed on the nominating committee for, I think, you can only be on nominating for two terms. I don't know if I was on more than one, but after that I went to be the secretary, so I left the nominating committee for that. And in the once this group of people who were highly political and had been involved in governance from early on kind of moved off and retired or left or whatever happened, basically from then on, the Academic Staff Executive Committee has had no interest in finding people on their own but has welcomed all the suggestions from the nominating committee and barely blinks when names come forward.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't any kind of battle of wills anymore after that early period, which is a good thing because the nominating committee chair is an important function and the committee works very hard to talk people into putting themselves out there on a slate for an election and vetting people who want to be on some of the shared governance committees to make sure they're not coming in with an advanced agenda and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
while
I really relished working with academic staff governance early on because it had all these really political, kind of high-powered people, or not high-powered, but people in high positions on the campus who wanted to be on the executive committee. So it was a very interesting group to be involved with, and I was actually appointed 1 year to serve on the executive committee to replace someone who retired or left early for some reason. And I barely said a word. I was so intimidated by all these people who you know, knew a lot and said a lot and were highly respected by the administration. Now, it's a different world, and the nominating committee has a very difficult time recruiting people to serve on the executive committee. People end up being elected who have no prior experience in governance and don't have any history of what went on before. And you get a lot of fresh looks that way, but at the time when academic staff governance was new and policies needed to be established, you were very fortunate to have people who were very interested in it and very engaged in governance and in politics.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's different now, and it doesn't have to be. It's fine because the policies are in place and there aren't big onerous issues to resolve. It doesn't seem to me like. Of course, they might think that any issue that they're talking about is big and important, but truly not like it was in the beginning.
Yeah. Before you became Secretary of the Academic Staff, were you on any other committees? Were you involved in governments in any other ways?
Well, I was an assembly alternate. I was on this gender equity study. I was on the grievance committee, and I was on the nominating committee.
Okay.
And I spent a year on the executive committee.
Okay, right.
So I had some experience
and what were the major issues when you were on the executive committee for that 1 year? And even beyond that, what at that period of time, what were the major issues do you think the academic staff was, I don't know if they could be called battles, but what were they trying to accomplish on campus?
Gosh, I wish I could remember. One of the things they were doing was to try to put together a document, which I might have mentioned before, called A Vision Shared, which wanted to lay out what they would like to see happen regarding academic staff and the campus in the years to come. And I was even on one of those panels, and I cannot even remember what we did. I know that an issue that comes back all the time is collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
So continually fought and fight to keep faculty and academic staff salaries together, to keep that from being separated.
Mm-hmm. So that's an issue now, and it was an issue then.
Right. It's been an issue. It's come up, I don't know, it comes up about every 6 years, just when a fresh new people on the executive committee have not remembered it. And in those early days, they were establishing procedures regarding treatment of academic staff in layoff or non-renewal situations. So they were writing policies and procedures relating to appeals, relating to layoffs and non-renewals, and various rights.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember, though, sitting in the meeting, what people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But that must have been some of it.
Was it your, do you have memories of there being resistance across campus to some of the things that the academic staff was trying to do at that time?
Not resistance across campus. The resistance would come from the administration.
Okay.
So they would meet with the provost, who at that time I believe was John Wiley, with some idea, and that was the person that had to be convinced.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know at the time that how much input the executive committee got from the population at large.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their ideas, and they wanted to get them across to the provost that they met with.
And so the provost had to approve these ideas before they could...
Well, you needed the provost to be on board to convince the chancellor, if that's the kind of issue it was. Mm-hmm. So any change to academic staff policies and procedures had to have the approval of our administration before it could go to system for final approval by the regents. So there was some of that going on.
And was Wiley generally supportive?
Generally. He was a super quick study.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to, and very much matter of fact, tell it like it is kind of person. Mm-hmm. So people needed to come to him with all their ducks in a row. And he would, I guess, tell them what they needed to know, yes or no, or go back to the table and figure it out again.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of respect for his decisions.
Right.
That reminded me of something, but I forgot.
Okay, we might come back. So tell me how you got to be Secretary of the Faculty.
Oh, that's just exactly what I was going to say.
Academic staff.
So while I was on the executive committee for that year, the secretary at that time was Steve Myra. And Steve and I had gotten to know each other maybe from some other committee. I can't remember what our connection was. And then I was on the... that's not right. Back up. The person who was secretary of the academic staff... Is that right? I can't remember if there was... Oh, yeah. Bob Miller was the first secretary of the academic staff, and he retired, I think, early for medical reasons. And so the position was open. And so I went, I thought, well, I could apply for this. But I'm pretty sure I hadn't been on the executive committee yet, but maybe I had. I don't think I had. So anyway, I thought, well, that can't hurt. So I applied for it, and I don't know how many candidates they had, but the person who got it was Steve Myra. And he had been involved in early governance, and he was a well-known entity, and he had been working in student financial services for quite a few years, and of course I was pretty new to campus. So that was fine. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. So then I was on ASEC for a year, and I watched Steve in action, and I thought, I am so glad I did not get that job. I do not like what he has to do.
Oh.
But
because he had to do what kinds of things?
Well, because there's this big committee, and they were he was taking notes, and they were telling him, Steve, do this, Steve, do that. And I thought, oh, my God, that would just have been the most horrible job, because I don't like to be ordered around. So... then Steve and I became friends, and I don't know exactly what all the intersections were, but so we would meet regularly for lunch, and finally he decided to retire after about 6 years on the job for also medical reasons. So this, and now I'm on the nominating committee at the time, and I thought, I don't know. I didn't like that job. Well, Steve kept telling me, he said, this is the greatest job on campus. You would really like this job. And he went on, and you know, I had went up to his office and was familiar with the surroundings and kind of what he did, although every time I called up there, he wasn't there. I thought, well, maybe this is a good job because you don't have to be there. But anyway, so While I did like my job a lot at DoIt, I was in publications and doing some training, and I had a staff, and I, you know, was very independent, and I liked it. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, you know, I still have 10 more years of my career here. Maybe I should branch out, and this would be a different opportunity, and I know a lot of people, and it would be okay. So, and people encouraged me to apply, but then other people would say, well, you know, this job is very political. I don't expect, you know, don't expect us to get it, which I didn't. But anyway, I sent in my materials finally just before the deadline, and got to the interview stage, and was a finalist, and then they offered me the job, and I really had to take a step back because I thought, what am I getting myself into? Mm-hmm. I really didn't like what I saw when Steve was doing the job. Mm-hmm. I really like what I'm doing now. Mm. But I thought, well, I need to do this. I need to make this change. So I accepted the job, and I have been very glad that I did because it was a great job. And
people didn't order you around as much as you had perceived.
They didn't.
Them to
I mean, from what people have told me about the new secretary that took my place, they're doing a lot of ordering her around. But she's really new to the campus and new to the environment, and so it's not like they're ordering her around, but she's being asked to do things where I might have been able to, A, say no, mm-hmm. or B, do them easily and not feel like I was being ordered to do something I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
So they're probably enjoying that, actually, having somebody who will do exactly what they want without questioning it or fighting it. But in the early going, I'm sure I must have felt put upon at times. But I never remembered thinking it was anything but just a really great job. Mm-hmm. I got to be at Bascom and work even more independently. I mean, just absolutely, totally on your own, mm-hmm. except that you have to answer to the committee people, but the committee people change, and you're still there.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Very carry the history.
Right. Very quickly, you know much more than they do about what goes on, and can carry on. So.
So what did you do day to day? I mean, you spent 10 years in
that
position, so that's quite a long time.
Right.
What kinds of things did you
do? And you need to, I went to all the executive committee meetings and all the assembly meetings, took the minutes, wrote the minutes, distributed the minutes, prepared an agenda, got the various guests that they wanted to appear, arrange those, did all the administrative support for excellence awards, for professional development grants, for the mentoring committee, handled roundtable.
And that was something that had not happened much on campus.
It had happened on campus, but traditionally, I think it goes way back. Like I said, I'm not much of a historian, so I just go forward with whatever. But it was a very old tradition to have faculty members or campus members, researchers, give talks at luncheons to the university community. And it had been traditionally, as far as I know, through the maybe the 80s, co-chaired by a faculty member and an academic staff member. And then and they did the program, organized the programs, and then I'm not sure exactly who did the support. Oh, the union did the registration support. Well, when I came on as secretary, the years just prior to my being secretary, they could not get a faculty member to participate. No. And the union was not wanting to do the administration support anymore. So they came up with this idea that maybe I could do it from my office. And I said, okay. I mean, personally, I like to be really busy. I don't like to be sitting there doing nothing. And so bring it on is kind of my idea for things to do. So the first year, a colleague and I, an academic staff member and I, did the programming, and I took on the sending out, doing the publicity and doing the reservations and choosing the menus and doing the whole thing. And then, so we did it for 2 years, and then we turned over the program chairs to two more academic staff because mm-hmm. faculty just wouldn't do it. But I kept all the administrative part. And there's a fall series and a spring yeah. series, and there's a lot of steps to it. So anyway, I did that for all 10 years and worked really well.
Yeah.
It went from, it had gotten to a very small group of people who came as it kind of fizzled. I built it way back up to at the December program, which is largely musical, mm-hmm. we'd have 200 people
wow.
registered. So it worked really well. Now, this new secretary did not really want to do it. So she did no flyer, no hard copy flyer, and she turned over all the reservations to the Office of Human Resource Development.
Mm-hmm.
And that may work perfectly fine, but I guess I never even thought of that as an option. It was just part of my job,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I did not mind doing it. So, anyway.
Huh. So what kinds of, so that's a sweep of 10 years that you
right.
were secretary. You did the round table. What other kinds of accomplishments did you look at as being something that you contributed to in those years?
I think my biggest accomplishment, and I think one of the reasons that they hired me was nothing in the office was done electronically. And I mean, this was 10 years ago. I came from Do It. The person in the office, Steve, he was just, had no interest and no ability technologically. And either did his assistant, who ended up being my assistant. But anyway, I completely moved the whole office into the technology age.
Right.
With elections being held online, documents being distributed online. I set up a big website and did much by email and listserv and all of that. So that's probably why they wanted me to have the job, and that's what I did with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the funny thing about it is, over the years, as things became more electronic, they could be done faster,
mm-hmm.
and there was less to do because, you know, you just could. And another ramification of that was that Julie, my assistant, who had been there through the first secretary, most of her work had been typing for these two men, and there wasn't really that much typing anymore, and it was faster for me to do half the jobs and explain it to her.
Yeah.
So while she was just the nicest person, and she had very good phone presence, and she was, you know, very kind and very willing to do what she was asked, she did not have the initiative to build any skills on her own. So I ended up doing much of the work that she used to do, because I would rather do it myself to keep busy, and I could just do it faster. So she ended up, we did lots and lots, hundreds of appointment letters, mm-hmm. and then thank you letters and letters and all kinds of things, letters about professional development grants and things, which as the years went by, I did more and more emails rather than mm-hmm. letters. Mm-hmm. But anyway, one of the reasons I took on Roundtable early on was to have something more for her mm-hmm. to do, because mm-hmm. I could just see that her work was just dwindling from what she had used to do with the two yeah. guys who yeah. didn't use yeah. computers. So in a little bit of irony, when I was leaving, when I was retiring, and I talked to the provost's office assistant, I said, you know, Julie has worked 80%. She did not have 80% worth of work to do. You could easily hire someone 50% mm-hmm. to as an assistant, because, you know, otherwise the secretary is going to be not having enough to do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot more of the job to increase. One thing I didn't do as much as I could, and what is now going to be done by a whole new committee called the Communications Committee, was keep the website completely up to date. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, that was an additional task. But other than that, I don't see what else they could have given her as an ongoing task. So, but what has happened, I understand, is she's hired a full-time person. Now, maybe, you know, because she's new, she's feeling a little overwhelmed and that she can't do it all. But I suspect that I don't see how it can keep two full-time people working. So that's just my take on it.
Yeah. So what, how much, tell me about the work that you did with the assembly and the executive committee, because you said they were the ones that you took the minutes for the meeting, but then also there must have been a lot of work coming from that.
Right.
So
not a whole lot of work coming from that. Well, one thing that did change from the early days of governance and from the secretary's job changed when I took it in one aspect. The secretary's office used to be kind of spearhead the lobbying effort at the Capitol for academic staff. Wow. But right before I took the job, a separate organization was formed called ASPRO.
Okay.
To do the lobbying, to be the lobbying arm. And that went away from the secretary job, thank goodness, because I did not want to be a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. That was just not my thing.
So you knew that was going.
I knew that was going. Mm-hmm. So, so the executive committee meets almost weekly. So there were agendas to be prepared, working with the chair, minutes to be written and distributed, and then that cycle just, it was so ongoing,
yeah,
and I
right,
just did
right.
not, that's one thing I did not like doing, but it was important and you had to do it. And the assembly then met once a month, and there were minutes and agendas for that. Those minutes are taped, but I never use the tape. I don't like listening to the tape, so I just took my own notes and did the minutes from that.
What kinds of issues were coming up during that?
Again, issues. You'd think that would be the most important thing that was going on, and people would always ask me about, what are the issues? And I'd go, issues?
It was the day-to-day
yeah, right.
work.
Yeah.
Like that's what you were responsible for. Right?
Yeah. Well, one big issue that unfortunately has still not been resolved is that academic staff wanted to get recognition for instructional and research academic staff who have been long-term on campus mm-hmm. and who are highly respected in their field, either on campus or beyond, mm-hmm. to get a retitled, to get an honorific title of instructional professor. Mm-hmm. That issue has been on the table for many years, and for several years we fought it very hard.
Against having that?
No, to have that, okay. To get the recognition so that they could sign student letters of recommendation,
yeah.
instructional professor, because mm-hmm. a lot of campuses, they don't understand our titles,
yeah.
you know, and it wasn't going to bring money, it was just going to be an honorific title, but one they could use officially. Mm-hmm. Well, many documents were prepared with the criteria that you would need to get this particular title, and once this was done, we had to take it to the faculty, because the faculty make a lot of decisions regarding things that they think they need to have a say in, and the faculty said, no, the word professor belongs to us. We are not going to go along with that. So, okay, back to the drawing board. So anyway, I let it drop for a couple years, and then there's new people, and not in the Faculty Senate, unfortunately, but in the University Committee. And they brought it up again. And this time, with the support of the University Committee, they went back to the Faculty Senate. And the Senate said, well, okay, we will allow the title of research professor. And if the person comes forward with a packet, and we have a committee, and they, which made up of faculty, who agree that the person is worthy. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a crumb, and the academic staff took it, and over the years, hardly any of them have decided it was worth putting together the packet to get that title.
Because mm-hmm. it didn't have any monetary
value. No, but I'd say maybe over the years, maybe there have been five of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, they still would like to have, and then we went to System with it. Well, System in the meantime decided that instructional academic staff were not getting the respect they deserve. So they did a study system-wide of instructional academic staff, of which our little piece with these titles was involved. And System was fully supportive of it, went back to the faculty, and they turned it down. Completely. So there was instructional, or still do not have a professorial title option. So that was an issue that came up over the years.
What's the relationship between the academic staff and the faculty senate, the academic staff executive committee and the
Well, statutorily, the faculty have jurisdiction over the academic goings-on the campus. And
sole jurisdiction.
Yep. So, while when academic staff got statutory rights to govern themselves, what academic staff have a say in is anything that affects them, their personnel issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the faculty have a say over everything.
Okay.
And they will be sure to tell you that. That's why right now, with this research enterprise business, why all these focus groups? Because the faculty have a right to say it up or down, which frustrates every administration no end, especially somebody like Biddy, who comes in from Cornell, where administration does what they want.
Yeah.
Here, nobody does what they want if the faculty doesn't say they can. So, and in the Faculty Senate, there are kind of two groups. There are the old guard, traditionalist professors who have been in the Faculty Senate for their career, and they have opinions, and they're very conservative. The other big group in the Faculty Senate are the very junior faculty who've been nominated by their departments to go be a faculty senator because the real faculty, you know, the mainstream faculty don't want to do it.
So is it untenured faculty? Would it be assistant professors yet?
Yes, I believe so. Ooh. Now, I could be wrong about that. It might just be tenured. But anyway, they're the newer, younger ones. They have to be tenured. Yeah, they can't be associate. But anyway, I think, because I could be wrong, because it seems like if they were assistant, they wouldn't have any governance and rights, and they have to have governance rights. It must be any of them. But whatever, they're young, and they're not necessarily tenured, so they're not going to speak up.
Right.
So, and
so the old guard kind of
rules. The old guard rules, and they don't want anything that, you know, speaks of uppityness from the academic staff. So anyway, that's been a problem ongoing with collective bargaining, also with...
Yeah, so tell me about collective bargaining. With,
well, every so often the legislature wants the campuses to be allowed to have collective bargaining. And I guess it doesn't necessarily been generated by the governor. The push comes from the outlying campuses, where the faculty and specifically feel like Madison gets all the money, and that if they had collective bargaining rights on their campuses, that they would not, you know, get the dribs and drabs of salary money left over. So while the Madison campus usually wins out because, and truly they should, because before merger, which a lot of people would say things went to hell in a handbasket after merger, but I mean, this is the flagship campus. This is the campus where faculty have to compete with jobs for other big schools. They're not competing with people, you know, applying for jobs at Stevens Point. So it's true that the Madison campus faculty get the money, but that's market driven. But anyway, so the big pushes from collective bargaining come from the outlying parts of the state, and also from some legislators who just like unions and that think that that system works. So the pressure comes on the governor from out the state to go forward with not to form unions, but to give faculty and staff the right to choose. And personally, I mean, academic staff governance just gets all upset when this happens because they just worry that we'll get collective bargaining. But I personally think give people the right to choose and then make the case that they don't choose it. To me, that just seems democratic. But
so why do they not want collective bargaining?
Because collective bargaining means unions, and unions means maybe possibly the end of governance.
Okay, so the feeling is governance is working well.
Right.
academic staff have a say in things. They're
right.
on committees.
Right.
And collective bargaining would only damage that.
Right. It would split the faculty and academic staff into separate unions. They'd
uh-huh.
be fighting
yeah, yeah.
for
okay,
the same
so
pots.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And, you know, it would... It wouldn't be good.
So it's not just about collective bargaining. It's about being split off from the faculty.
Right. And just not having... I mean, governance gives academic staff power to be on committees, especially on search and screens,
mm-hmm.
and a say in their own business, where the unions might spell the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
unions, I don't believe that you could make any kind of case on this campus for, and the legislation says that the unions can be by campus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot less threatening because
I
don't believe Madison's academic staff would choose unions given a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But to keep people from having a choice, I don't think it's worth fighting for. But it gets everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And they like an issue. And another issue that's more recent is sabbaticals for academic staff.
Mm-hmm.
So they put together a proposal, trying very hard not to call it sabbaticals because that looks like something a faculty only have. So it's called instructional leave. And I think maybe that they might have some success in that.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I read again in your dedication, it talked about you're serving on these search and screen
mm-hmm.
committees. So that was not always the case, that
no.
academic staff could do that.
Well, this what they're talking about in my case is that I, about 5 years ago, they asked me to staff a search and to run a search and screen.
For what kind of a position?
For high-level administrative
uh-huh.
Jobs. So the secretary of the faculty does, his office does the staff support for the high-level deans,
mm-hmm.
all the faculty positions. But more and more there were vacancies in top administrative positions. And
which are academic staff positions.
Right. Which so several of them were done out of Darryl Bazell's office, the vice chancellor. And so I started out helping his assistant with a couple of searches. One was for, in the early days, one was for Alan Fish's, the job
oh, okay.
he has now for
okay.
facilities, and one was for the head of the union,
mm-hmm.
Mark Guthier.
Mm-hmm.
So we did those together, and then I started doing them on my own.
Mm-hmm.
So then I, 1 year, I was absolutely overwhelmed. These things take a lot of work, and luckily I got support for myself for doing letters and things from an assistant in the chancellor or provost office. So Julie, my assistant, could stick with the governance stuff,
mm-hmm.
and she just wouldn't have been able to do it anyway because it required some technology. So anyway, they gave me a dean of student search and the head of legal services
oh.
search and the director of the hygiene lab. I guess Donna and I did that together. Anyway, quite a few of them came up over the years.
What would you do when you were doing these search and screen? It's the first pass, is that right, on the applications that come in? It's putting out the announcements.
Right.
Broadly, making sure the announcements are going out to the right people. But then once the initial applications come in, kind of doing the first cut?
No, it's working with the committee and the chair of the committee. And these committees can be very big because lots of people want representation on these committees. So your committee can be as big as 15 people with a faculty chair. So you would kind of talk to the committee chair about how to run the meetings. And you meet with the search committee, work up the PVL. Once it's done, work out the publicity, where it's going, and then work with the advertisers to put it in their publications or whatever. Then once that's all out, then you wait for the applications to come in, and then do all the copying or distributing, and do minutes and agendas, help the committee develop a process for reviewing, help them develop interview questions, make all the arrangements with the people they start to interview for each, send letters to the people that are rejected. Okay. And so there's
so
just
it's the whole thing. It's the whole thing from beginning
from start,
all the way to the end.
Yeah. Then, you know, once they have a finalist list, then you have the three finalists or five come to campus. So you make all the flight arrangements, hotel arrangements, who escorts them from one building to another, because they meet with a lot of different groups, setting up all those groups and meetings. And it's a huge amount of work.
I would imagine.
So, but another thing I like to do, because it took up a lot of time and space, and I met so many people that I would not otherwise have met.
Right.
Often the committees had people from the community, that it had faculty, it had academic staff, it had not classified staff, but classified non-rep staff, a couple of students.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, and a lot of meetings. So, and it usually took 6 months from start to finish.
Yeah, yeah.
So a long time, a lot of work.
And but sometimes you would have a couple of these at the same time that you were working on.
Yeah. It seemed like there would be none or there would be two.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was, I liked it. It was a fun part of the job. A lot of confidentiality issues.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of management of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the success, or not the success, but the best search and screen committees depended on the chair.
Mm-hmm.
And some had just chairs who were just superb, and others who just left it all to me, you know, kind of just showed up.
Right.
So.
Oh, my.
I know. But all in all, I really enjoyed that part of the job once I got into it.
Yeah.
So
if you could characterize the shift of the place of academic staff on campus from the time you started to the time you left. I know that's, you were in particular positions at particular times, and but you had a broad view also.
Right. I think from the time I started to the time I left, the rights and protections for academic staff became stronger, not having anything to do with me whatsoever, but the rights and protections for academic staff are in place.
Mm-hmm.
So since 1985, when governance kind of began its committee work, much work has been done. I mean, a huge amount of work by committees. And because these protections are in place and ways to grieve are in place, there aren't that many big issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they continue to make mountains out of molehills, and there's, you know, there's always climate concerns,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you can go round and round with all these things. But academic staff, as far as rights and policies, have it pretty much in place.
Mm-hmm.
What's weakened, I believe, are the the executive committee members, because it's very hard now with, you know, people doing more with less, that getting people to serve and getting release time, and with this effort reporting that came into place, I don't think you get people that are as engaged in and have as much experience serving on the executive committee. And I think having a rather lightweight or weakish executive committee kind of gives you less clout with the administration. Mm-hmm. Luckily, we don't have huge issues to work with.
Maybe those things go hand in hand.
Yeah, maybe.
There's not big issues, therefore you don't have an executive committee that's stepping up to it.
And right, and you don't have people who are willing to get in there and fight for something because there's not that much to fight for. Right, they've been fought.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's my feeling. Mm-hmm. I don't know that everyone would share it. Over the times I've been in governance, there were some chairs who were just not very good, but the committees as a whole were good. So unlike a search and screen, the committee did not depend entirely on the chair, mm-hmm. because the secretary really manages how things function, and the chair shows up and runs the meeting. But
you were at all of these committee meetings,
right,
as well.
No, not all the committees.
Okay.
The committees, the economic staff committee is really the easiest one to be on if you have the free time to be on the committee, because you really just have a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do anything.
The academic staff executive committee?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the standing committees, okay, the policies committee, the recognition committee, the nominating committee, those other committees actually do things. Mm-hmm. They have duties to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So those committees work hard, way independently of the executive committee that just meets with the provost and makes kind of executive talk.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So while it's more meetings, it's not that much work outside of that. I mean, they do decide on their priorities for the year, which always include more participation in governance, fight collective bargaining, and get sabbaticals, and, you know, they're all important, but they're not earth-shattering
mm-hmm.
issues.
Mm-hmm.
And one year we wanted to, you know, have a kind of a green campus campaign, but, you know, what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thought, and we kind of pushed it by talking about it, but I don't know that, you know, we didn't do away with the coal processing plant and
uh-huh,
that kind
uh-huh,
of thing.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, in that order, they would have somebody come in from facilities and planning to talk about what was being done. So they kind of learn. They
mm-hmm.
learn what's going on, and they make people aware of who they are. They have all the new deans come in
mm-hmm.
for a meeting, and they meet with the chancellor once a year or twice, and just make faculty and leadership aware of academic staff. And that's, if they can do that, they've done a good
mm-hmm.
job,
mm-hmm.
in my view.
So academic staff has certain rights now, and they're
mm-hmm.
serving on certain committees
mm-hmm.
that are shared governance committees.
Right.
Has that translated itself into any kind of day-to-day work respect on the campus that academic staff have vis-a-vis faculty or...
Well...
Or the administration, for that matter?
I hope so. One thing that evolved over the last 10 years anyway, there are, for example, there are one large shared governance committee is the Committee on Women in the University. And it has all of these faculty so-called committees have a majority of faculty. But when it comes to having meetings, who shows up to the meetings more regularly is academic staff. Who is willing to take on more of the work of the committee? It's academic staff. So that being the case, on a couple of committees, the faculty, in agreement, went to the Faculty Senate and said, would it be all right if academic staff co-chaired the committee? Because faculty are supposed to chair all these committees. And they said no.
Because they wanted to be in the driving seat, well, even if the faculty weren't doing right, as much of the work as the academics.
They didn't want to give up anything.
Yeah.
Well, with some more push by the committees themselves, they did allow that two committees on campus could be co-chaired by academic staff. One was the Committee on Women, of course, and the other was, I think, retirement issues, or some really not very important committee. Mm-hmm. So...
Now, is the Committee on Women viewed as a not so
important? They're a very active committee, but I don't think for some reason the faculty worried about having an academic staff co-chair that one.
Okay.
So a little bit of progress was made. Another committee, one committee that's very powerful on this campus is the Athletic Board,
mm-hmm.
to the point where when we have a vacancy, we do a recruitment for that committee. And it's very, very heavily faculty. And the way it's written, the policies for that committee, there have to be X amount of faculty, and then there could be, I don't know, 12 faculty and 3 academic staff and 3 students. So they kind of have equal academic staff and students, and then a whole raft of faculty. And we have tried on several occasions to have an additional academic staff member to that committee, because it would give an academic staff member a chance, and it's a very highly sought committee. And the academic staff who have been on it always work very hard. I mean, it's a committee that takes a lot of time because they do lots of real work, but they've never been successful.
Like what kind of work do they do?
They review all the athletic programs. They review the coaches. They review the contracts.
Oh, okay.
They review the salaries. They have actual quite a bit of power. And I think that they actually do some, you know, an athletic board person might accompany a team as a chaperone. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You really get people who are into athletics who want to be on that board. And that's okay, but they work hard.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you said how many academic staff are on that?
I think there's two.
Two, okay.
Only.
So you were trying to get a third person
right.
on, and the answer has been no.
No.
Yeah. Because it tips the balance too.
Well, because in order to get another person, then they think they would have to add a student, and then they would have to go to the Faculty Senate and get it approved, so they just... It's not worth the faculty's time to bother with it, so they don't. But it would serve them well in all of these committees to increase academic staff who are on it because they're genuinely interested and are willing to work.
Mm-hmm.
Where faculty often, you know, they have the service leg of their supposed life, and so they will allow themselves to be on a committee to serve that function. So they're not as wholly invested in it as... they otherwise could be. And this isn't true with all of them, but it tends to happen.
What are some of the other committees that academic staff are particularly, or the other really key committees you think on campus that academic staff now serve on that maybe didn't in the past?
I'm not sure there are any mean, we've had representation once we had governance on most of the committees.
Okay. And that was written out specifically. It's two, the numbers for each.
Each one are, they're different.
Mm-hmm.
Some have, and the terms are also different. Mm-hmm. So athletic board is unusual, and I think they're 4-year terms. And like union council are 2-year terms, but generally everything else is 3.
Mm-hmm.
So it's written up in the faculty's policies and procedures, how these committees are structured.
Mm-hmm.
But some are more desirable, like people like to be on the transportation committee, mm-hmm. because everybody's interested in parking issues. And the university bookstore committee comes with some perks, so that's another kind of desirable one. Lakeshore preservation, if people mm-hmm. are interested in that. There's student misconduct mm-hmm. committees. I can't say that people fight to get on that. I don't know how much work they have to do on it, but
yeah.
That's a fairly big committee, because when they have an issue, they have to pull together a panel.
Yeah.
And then there are lesser ones like the library committee and the memorial library committee and archives committee, and you know, you'll get someone who's really interested, but people aren't clamoring to be mm-hmm. universally mm-hmm. on those mm-hmm. committees. So
one of the things I thought was really interesting when I got involved in a committee on academic staff issues in the School of Ed is I'm not exactly sure how I got on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was volunteered by somebody and I said fine, but and I had been an academic staff on campus for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
but being on the committee gave me the identity of an academic staff
mm-hmm.
person. And I didn't have that identity before, even though I was academic staff.
Oh.
But there's something about, I came to understand involvement of in governance
mm-hmm.
as then making one aware
mm-hmm.
that is one's identity.
Right.
So it doesn't, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about whether the spread of how much that identity has spread on campus,
mm-hmm.
that academic staff actually do understand themselves to be academic staff versus, you know, I understood myself to be a researcher,
mm-hmm.
or I understood myself in this job to be a student service coordinator.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, and one of the best things to me that came out of governance were the committees on academic staff issues in the colleges. And this started being written just before I became secretary. So, and then it took a few years to get finalized and get having these start up. But I think before, academic staff governance was just at the top, kind of a layer up. But because of continuing problems that came up of one type or another, lots of them related to just climate issues, having establishment of the committees on academic staff issues in the colleges and schools, they were set up as advisories to the dean. So they actually gave an elected group of academic staff a meeting with the deans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this was really a big fundamental change. And I think for academic staff themselves, who, you know, now could be elected, you know, by their peers, not having to do with the whole campus of people they didn't know, but actually right in their college,
mm-hmm.
being able to talk about issues and be elected and be involved with the dean. I think that was kind of the highlight of governance in the last
mm-hmm.
15 years anyway. And there was some talk about having something similar to at the department level, but that never got anywhere. Personally, I don't see the value in it. But I think at the campus at the school and college level. It was a great thing. And it's, when it first got going, it was a big deal, and every school and college had one, and the academic staff executive committee made sure that they met with the deans and explained the how this was going to work, and actually made the dean responsible, which the dean usually passed down to an associate dean, but it happened. Now I think some of the CASEs have kind of floundered or just kind of dried up, but lots of them are keeping going, and I think they're a very positive thing.
I mean, I certainly remember it being a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got roped into it. I wasn't an elected person, but I roped into it. It's just a meeting. But
yeah.
Then I got on there, I realized this is a lot of work.
Yeah.
So committees were doing, there were subcommittees to the CASEs,
mm-hmm.
and they were doing a lot of work
mm-hmm.
in the school and college. So.
Yeah. And there's been, for the last bunch of years, there's been an Academic Staff Leadership Institute, which is a half-day thing that MASA co-sponsors, which to me seems to attract about the same 100 people every year. So I'm not, people are just determined to keep it going, but the few years I was involved in it, I felt like a lot of resources were being spent with very little gain, because the same people who were involved in the assembly and MASA, so you're always speaking to the choir, and you, every year you talk about, well, we want to get new people, invite new people, and you just don't get new people, or very few.
Right.
So people insist on keeping it going, but I kind of became a wet blanket and said, I am not being involved in this
mm-hmm.
thing. If this is going to happen, have a committee, but I'm not on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you've been there a long time, you can just say
Right. So some of this you attribute to the fact that the issues, the biggest, hardest, most protracted issues, well, not that there aren't chronic issues,
right.
but the hard fought rights
mm-hmm.
have been won.
I think so.
And now it's just dealing
yeah.
with small things
right.
and campaigns for this event.
Right, and like the academic staff, since I still have been reading I still get the executive committee minutes and agendas, and I read them and I think, I am so glad to be retired. but what they're talking about now is, of course, the splitting up of the research of the grad school. And they're all interested in how that's going to come out, because I guess it does affect academic staff in various ways that I'm just not familiar with what's going on there. But I know that they're, you know, want to be very involved and are very concerned about that, and they also want to get through this instructional leave proposal. So there's always a current issue,
mm-hmm.
you know, to joust about,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and collective bargaining was won a couple years ago, and but from my early perspective to now, I think it's very quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
right.
and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So tell me about retirement.
Oh,
how did
retirement
you decide
is good.
When to retirement, or when to go into retirement?
Well, I guess a couple years ago, I just decided that when I turned 65, I'd worked enough, I could afford to retire, and I just picked a date.
So 65, because it's the traditional time that people...
Well, because I could get Social Security,
yeah.
and I
yeah.
could afford it.
Yeah.
I mean, as a single parent, you know, for a lot of years, I probably retired, you know, retirement earlier might have been appealing, but I just thought, no, I really have to work until I'm 65, and actually almost 66, so that I can get full Social Security, and then I will have worked enough, and it just turned out to be There was nothing to make me retire earlier than that or keep me retiring longer. So I told the provost in December, who was at that time Pat Farrell, and then it turned out he was leaving, and then the chancellor was leaving. So not that any of that made any difference whatsoever to me. It just, I just stuck with my plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the job, I always liked the job, and I didn't want to get, so I didn't like it. I don't know if that would have happened, but, you know, it, after that many years, it became fairly routine.
Mm-hmm.
Other than having the search committees, which were all very different in the makeup of the people and in the types of candidates and the different positions, the job was very much administrative support, so you were doing the same thing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you schedule your whole year.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I don't know, I was just tired of doing it. But it was a job well suited to me. I told my friends I always wanted to have a job at a desk with a cup of coffee, and I truly got that.
But you were out and about quite a bit,
yeah.
Despite that.
Oh, yeah. And I, you know, met many, many people, you know, from Roundtable and from governance. And I learned to do my job so that I could do it easily and well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a good time. And now
I'm
hoping I can still be healthy and have more good
right.
times.
And you're still involved in the university
yeah.
in some ways. How are you continuing?
Well,
because you've been here since you were a kid.
Yeah, I said I was going to stay away for a while, but I still, as a volunteer, I'm still putting together the newsletter for the Retirement Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm involved in Plato. Do you know what that is?
The
participatory learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm doing that. And but
so say a little bit more though about Plato. So
it's a program for seniors that's partly supported by the Office of Continuing Studies,
okay.
the Division of Continuing Studies on campus. They do some of the support, but the group has many, many different groups to be involved in, and so you can pick an interest and there's a group. And I volunteered to be on the special events committee, which plans the dates for like the new members coffee and the meeting where you can go and learn about all the different programs that they have, and then I go to a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just telling somebody this morning, because I came here from the Global Affairs lecture, which is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And then a bunch of us from Global Affairs have lunch, and then I came here, and it's like, I am so busy. I'm beginning to feel rushed. Every day, and I should be, I'm retired.
You
know, I was like, what is this? But, you know, I have been very busy with one thing and another, and but it's things I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I,
mm-hmm.
you know, I chose to do them. It isn't that somebody is making me do them. So just the greatest thing.
Yeah, and I think it's just interesting that you've continued the connection with the university.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so strong
oh,
in
yeah.
you that you couldn't just walk
yeah.
out and not
right.
involved in some way.
Yeah, my classmate, Dave Musoff, who is the secretary of the faculty, he and his partner live in Lake Mills, in a farm outside of Lake Mills, that they do sustainable agriculture and wetlands protection, and they're very, very involved in that kind of thing. And they work very hard in a huge garden and chickens and I don't know what else. But so Dave is continuing to work, and I said, you know, why don't you retire? He's been here longer than I have. And he said that he would have to find some kind of intellectual stimulation once he retires, because he's out at Lake Mills on the farm, but he's been involved in all these heady university political things all these years. That's a big, would be a huge change for him.
Right.
Where I'm in town, close to all this.
Yeah.
So I
can get it whenever you want.
Yeah, I can. And I never even, you know, considered that that would be an issue for anyone or for him.
Right.
You just have to find out, you know, what you can do that keeps you involved mm-hmm. in the campus in some way, or at least in learning or,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, in community.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But just being in Madison, boy, you could do as little or as much as you wanted. And plus, I found like this week I'm playing bridge 5 times. That doesn't happen most weeks, but I think that's just too much. How did that happen?
So I think we've covered most everything. Well, here's a question here, which I you may have addressed already, but let's see if you have any other thoughts. So you talked about participation in academic staff governance kind of dwindling a little bit from the heyday when people were joining committees and so forth,
right.
And now it sometimes isn't easy to get to find people to fill
right.
these spots. So do you feel like that has meant that the participation in academic staff governance is less well regarded now, or it's just not so much an issue?
I think there's two things. One, they're not heady issues that affect individuals, because the things that people care about, if you ask them on a survey, which we have done, it's salary and job security and benefits. If the issues are not surrounding these things that affect them personally, it's hard to get them involved. And most of those things have been addressed. I mean, collective bargaining hits at some of that, so that can get people riled up. But a lot of the things regarding how the university is organized, like the grad school, this doesn't hit that many people in their pocketbook or where they care about. So that has had an effect on participation. What was the other part of it? I guess I had another part of it.
Yeah.
The other thing is the demands of the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
People want to keep their jobs. They have a lot to do in their jobs. They just don't have time to keep balance in their lives, to get their work done, to take time for a committee and to, you know, go home to their kids or
mm-hmm.
to whatever. So
yeah,
if something isn't, you're not really interested in it, or it doesn't affect your life, I think you'd rather put your energies into doing a good job and then going home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one case in point, if we ever want to have a meeting, a general meeting for academic staff, such as MASA might want to do or has done in the past, you better have it at noon
mm-hmm.
or in the morning, because if you have it after work, people won't come because people want to go home.
Yeah.
So, and you can't blame them.
Yeah.
So.
How we haven't talked about MASA.
Uh-huh.
How was MASA related at all to the academic staff, executive committee, or the governance mm-hmm. issues at all?
Well, MASA, once again, I'm not too good at the history of this, but I think MASA was actually the people who formed MASA were the people who ended up actually creating the academic staff governance principles. So MASA's been around a long time. And for a while, it appeared to some of us who were active in MASA, that MASA did not no longer serve a purpose. For a while, it had some very, what I consider, poor presidents, didn't do much of anything, and not many people showed up for any meeting, and it was very mostly inactive. So there were several of us who said, you know, maybe with governance now so fully entrenched, maybe we don't need MASA, or MASA needs to find a niche that's not covered. So we talked about MASA being kind of a communications arm for academic staff, and yet it's a membership organization. It's not a governance group. It doesn't have the reach of governance. So, okay, well, maybe that's not it either. And we talked about disbanding it. But then, and I was one of the people in favor of disbanding it, but then the people who really wanted to keep it, because they felt that if a situation came up where academic staff governance, the executive committee or the assembly, felt that they couldn't take a stand against the administration because it would hurt them, that MASA could be an arm's length kind of mm-hmm. organization that could be one to do that. So they decided to keep MASA going, and MASA then took a turn to be more or less of a kind of a social organization. And it's actually, in my view, done a very good job since then.
Since it just decided to stop being political.
I don't think they made a conscious decision, but they decided to have more functions mm-hmm. for academic staff. And they got a group of people who were willing to take on putting programs together and publicizing them. And I think MASA's kind of made a comeback, mm-hmm. and I think they've done a very good service. So I'll have to say that it was probably good that they kept going and that they found something that was positive, and they have been, they've had, you know, social things, mm-hmm. breakfasts and tours and things, and they've also had some educational programs, and they've been willing to sponsor this institute, Leadership Institute. So, and I, you know, I continue to be a member and pay my dues, but I was vice something, and then president, and then I was on the advisory committee for many years until I said, I'm not on that anymore either. Time for new people, because you can get people who just won't get off of committees, and it's, you know, finally I just said, you need new advisors. Mm-hmm. So, but I think they've been, I'm very glad to say they've done a good job of raising their visibility and mm-hmm. and inviting academic staff to get together. A lot of times you're very much in your own little silo, and there aren't that many opportunities to get out. They used to have what they called Thursday. I don't know. But they were social events on Thursdays after work. And units would take them on.
For organizing them.
Yeah, uh-huh. and paying for them. Uh-huh. Like Ag would do it, or Cal's would do it, and then med school would, and they kind of rotated around. I can't remember the name of them now. Anyway, they were social hours, and they were advertised, and one year I convinced the Do It that we ought to be having one of these, and we organized it, and it's not cheap. I mean, you, mm-hmm. you had to get the food and then get, and usually I guess the union catered it, and you got a bartender and all that stuff. Like, people paid for their drinks, but you had to provide the food. Well, what happened, numerous of these, was students would read about it, and they would come and they would eat the food. I mean, people, staff and faculty would come too, but they'd kind of get invaded because they were like open houses, and they had some at the union, and sometimes, like, we had it in the lobby at CompSci. But anyway, they just became too expensive use foundation funds or whatever petty cash you had. So now I think the Pyle Center does something. I don't know who goes to them, but but just, you know, having people, there are just not that many ways to mingle. If you're not in governance, Massa is a good thing.
What, any final thoughts? Anything that you feel like you haven't said about your career here or academic staff that you think is important?
I am sure that once I leave this room, many things will come to mind.
Well, jot them down and we'll make another appointment.
Oh, okay. If there are enough. No, I can't think of anything right offhand.
Okay.
I think we've covered it.
So, well, thanks.
I think of other things.
Being candid and for spending time doing this. And appreciate it.